Translation. Lord Krishna has made a firm promise for all time. If one renders service unto him, Krishna correspondingly gives him an equal amount of success in devotional service to the Lord. Hare Krishna, everyone. Hare Krishna. Very nice to see you all. Very nice to see you all. Some of you I know. Many of you I don't know. But Hare Krishna. This is one of the longest purports in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'm not going to read it all. I'm going to try. But I'll read it paragraph by paragraph, because otherwise there'll be nothing for the next speaker to speak on. This is a very interesting purport. There are two things going on. One is to help us understand how to focus in on the actual details of devotional service, the details of bhakti, which is very important. The other thing is going on is to somehow or other engage others in the process of bhakti. These are two things which are always in competition with one another. Is it important for people to become vegetarian? Generally speaking, yes. Is it important for people to become vegetarian? Generally, no. Generally, no. They can start bhakti even if they're not vegetarian. We have many Namahata groups, I hate to tell you, many Namahata groups in Bengal and Bangladesh where they're chanting. They're chanting many rounds a day, the members of the villages, but they're not completely vegetarian. Oh, Hari Bapri, how terrible is that? And at the same time, where does bhakti begin? Bhakti begins where it begins. And therefore, bhakti said unto Saraswati, said, we will open a hostel in London, irrespective of the food that we have to serve there. Prabhupada told Harikesh Swami, go and preach in Moscow. He said, go and preach in Moscow. He said, but Prabhupada, is very difficult to find a vegetarian diet. Prabhupada said, ultimately, he said something like, damn your diet. He said, go and preach, just preach. So the point is, how can you preach if you're not practicing? This is what we hear all the time, isn't it? Well, how can you save a person from Maya? This is the point is, you have to be where that person is. So bhakti, or devotion to Krishna, begins with purification of the self. Purification of the self starts with the agency of the pure, the sadhu, who enters into the life of that person and brings them forward. Sometimes they bring them forward an inch, sometimes they bring them forward a mile. Bhakti also begins when you're off the bodily platform, when you're free from all inebrities, when you're free from all attraction to anything material. Then bhakti completely begins. Oh, I'm confused. Kripa Moya, you've confused everyone. Where does bhakti begin? It begins where the agency of the bhakti shakti begins. Hare Krishna. So when someone enters into a butcher's shop to give them one of Prabhupada's books, or when devotees go into a meat restaurant as part of their kirtan, as sometimes happens, or when people are pulled into the middle of the kirtan, and they may not be, they may be intoxicated, they may be smoking, they may be eating all kinds of nonsense. But when they're pulled into the middle of a kirtan, then they have begun, isn't it, Govinda? They've begun, their spiritual life has begun. But if they're still doing that after they come to the temple, then we say, not here, not now. Leave those things at the door, because the temple is a place we're actually doing bhakti. But you told me I was doing bhakti when I was pulled into the kirtan, an unsophisticated, unknowledgeable person. You told me I was beginning bhakti when you came and gave me a book in the McDonald's on the motorway service area, okay, at Milton Keynes Shopping Center. You told me my bhakti had truly begun. So where does bhakti begin? It is a sliding scale. It's a continuum. Where does light begin? Well, light is composed of a spectrum of different colors, and it begins where it begins, at a certain vibrational frequency, and then it goes all the way to the upper limits of light. So when bringing light into a person's life, we begin where they are usually. If you don't begin where the person is, then how will they ever have anything? So sometimes people say, where does it say in the Vedas that the guru has to be a human being? Where does it say in the Vedas that the guru has to be in his body? Where does the guru has to speak in the language of the person that they are trying to save? Well, the point is the Vedas are not foolish. In order to be a sadhu in someone's life, you have to extend yourself in the flesh, as it were, in the space that they occupy. And therefore Krishna says two things. One is that I come down in order to save. But when I come down, don't misunderstand who I am. Don't misunderstand that I'm like you, a Jopi son of Yayadma, Bhutana Mishwaropi son. Don't misunderstand me, my identity. You see? So this whole business of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is to come into the world and meet people where they are and save them where they are. Therefore, in many places, Prabhupada says, we don't mind what name of God you chant. Just chant the name of God as you know it to be. This is the Sankirtan movement. You can chant the name of Allah. You can chant the name of Buddha. You can chant the name of Jehovah. We don't mind what name you chant. See, we don't say chant our name for God. Just chant your name for God. This is the Sankirtan movement. And then we get tucked away in the middle of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we get a verse like this, which seems to indicate that only the process of Krishna consciousness, specifically the name of Krishna, will do. So how are we to understand that? If you don't understand this principle, that bhakti is a continuum, you'll get confused when you read this. When I read this purport, and when we discuss it. Is that okay? Any questions on my preface to even the purport? It's an important one to understand, because sometimes devotees use the wrong argument at the wrong time. They're in a specific argument about Krishna and Krishna bhakti. Then they will take the argument for the beginning of bhakti and say, well, it doesn't really matter what we do. It's all one. And this is a problem. Just like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When you first go to school, you learn A, B, C, D, E, F, G. This is the first letter that you write. Whether it's Sanskrit or Hindi or Russian or English, the letter A is pretty much the first letter. However, if the parents of the child come back a few years later in senior school and the child has written on the page A plus B equals C squared, and the parents go, why are you teaching my child the ABCs? They say, no, this is something different. No, this is not something different. My child has learned this a long, long time ago. A long time at the beginning. No, this is something different now. So in the same way, that little difference is what we discuss when we reach the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Don't think it's ABC. So, Prabhupada begins with a statement which will confuse those of you who may be coming earlier. It is a completely mistaken idea, Prabhupada says, that one can worship Krishna in any form or in any way and still attain the ultimate result of receiving the favor of the Lord. This is a decision made by gross materialists. So with this announcement of this purport, Prabhupada is settling into a long and protracted discussion of why all religions are not the same. Most of the people, including many, many devotees that we speak to, are convinced that every religion is the same and that every religion is bhakti. That every religion, because the one point of every religion is God, and there's only one God. Therefore, anyone who says the word God or begins a process of praying to God must therefore be on the path of bhakti. And immediately in the first sentence, Prabhupada says, no, that's not true. Not everything is bhakti. Well, Prabhupada, you said that if they chant Allah or Buddha or Jehovah or Krishna, it's all the same. It's all the name of God. It's all the beginning of bhakti. One time Prabhupada was in New York, where I have happily spent the last 5 weeks. And he said, controlling the tongue means only eating Krishna prasad. We offer Krishna many palatable dishes, and then we eat. Krishna eats first, and then we eat. So Krishna has a feast, and then we feast. And in this way, the tongue becomes controlled by eating only food which has been offered to Krishna. So, he said, controlling the tongue means feasting. And all the devotees went, Jai! Jai! He then flew to Los Angeles. The next morning he gave the Bhagavatam class. And as they often do, the verses move on in their understanding. And it was talking about fasting as a means of controlling the tongue. So Prabhupada said, so we must learn how to control the tongue by not eating. Fasting. Fasting is a way to control the tongue. So then, any questions? So then this hand slowly went up and said, Srila Prabhupada, yesterday in New York you said feasting was a way to control the tongue. And today you say fasting is a way to control the tongue. Which is it? Prabhupada just looked at the boy and he said, you listened to me yesterday? He says, yes. He said, then you listen to me today. Meaning that whatever conception you have come to, perhaps there's a refinement on that conception. Perhaps that what they told you when you first walked into the temple on the very first day is not everything. Perhaps you need to go further. And that's why you need to read the books. That's why we all need to read the books. I would love it if all religions were the same. It would make our preaching very easy. Very easy. However, preaching and understanding are two different things. What you tell someone in order to help them make their first step on the road of bhakti, and what we discuss here on a Saturday morning amongst ourselves and whoever is watching at home, welcome. These are two different things. Not different things, but part of the same thing, but part of a continuum. So Prabhupada immediately says, this is a decision made by gross materialists, that all religions are the same. How many times have you heard that? All religions are the same is a disparaging comment, isn't it? Because what do they usually follow that up with? I'm into spirituality, but I'm not into religion. How many times have you heard that? All right? And what do they mean? I like spiritual life, but I don't like religious institutions. Have you heard that one? I think all religions are the same. They all start wars. Have you heard that one? Prabhupada says these are the opinions of gross materialists. And we think, well, at least they're talking about spirituality and religious life. How gross can they be? No, he says these are gross materialists. To come to that conclusion is an aspect of gross materialism. Generally, such men say that you can manufacture your own way of worshipping the Supreme Lord, and that any type of worship is sufficient to approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Certainly, there are different means for attaining different results in fruit of activity, speculative knowledge, mystic yoga, and austerity. Crude men, first he says gross materialists, now he says crude. Crude men. Crude means, what does it mean, crude oil? Unrefined. That's right. Unpurified. Unrefined means that there's a process by which crude oil is turned into refined oil. Crude oil is as it comes. Refined oil is when it gets to the top of the, what do they call it? Evaporation tower. You pipe off the really refined petroleum spirit at the top. So that means it can be used for an airplane. You cannot stick crude oil into an airplane. You can't really use crude oil for very much because it's crude. The definition of crude is it means it must undergo some process in order to be usable for something higher. You know. So, crude men therefore say that one who adopts any of these methods achieves the Supreme Personality of God, its favor. They claim that it doesn't matter what kind of method one adopts. So then Prabhupada gives a general... Are we okay so far? Staying awake? I know it's hard. Prabhupada gives an analogy that is often given to you. People will say this to you, and they look at you and they'll go, uh-huh, okay? Okay, you understand? You understand where I'm coming from? I got you there, didn't I? A general analogy is given. If one wishes to arrive at a certain place, there are many roads leading there. And one can go to that place by any one of these roads. Similarly, these gross materialists say there are different ways to attain the favor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They claim that one can conceive of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Durga, Goddess Kali, Lord Shiva, Ganesh, Ramchandra, Krishna, the impersonal Brahman, or whatever. And one can chant the Lord's name in any way and in any form. So, give me some ways of combating this all roads lead to the same destination argument. Let's see if you're sharp at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. All roads. I'll be the crude materialist. So, my dear friends, any path leads you to God, because there is only one path, because that path is to God. So if I say that I'm on the path to God, and I'm starting where I'm starting, therefore my religion or my spiritual practice is the same as yours, and I will ultimately get the same result. What do you say? Mr. Birmingham preacher, what do you say?
If I'm taking the M1 north, it's not leading to London.
Good analogy. Good analogy. Did you hear what he said? The M1 north does not lead you to London. I was going to a program in, somewhere outside Birmingham. By mistake, on my GPS, I had pressed the button that said, avoid motorway. And I went on a very nice trip, and it taking all the villages of England. And we were going like this, and like this, and like this, and like this. And we were definitely going towards Birmingham, but ever so gradually. I think it took 3 times the time it should have taken. Yeah, yeah.
So I was going to say the same thing, that you're all heading the same direction, perhaps, but some will take much longer. Same argument, same answer, I suppose.
Yes. But then I can say, well, the path of bhakti seems to take you guys a long time as well. Who are you to tell me that the path of bhakti is a superior path or more direct path?
Because bhakti is scientifically proven as a path that will get us to Godhead much quicker.
Okay. That's one argument. Thank you. Vishrambara. All paths lead to Rome, Vishnambara.
I remember there was a lecture of Srila Prabhupada. I heard as a brahmachari cassette. Lecture, he said that all the religions are like many rivers. They all go in one ocean.
Okay.
And then later on he said, it's just like someone who wants to go to America, someone who wants to go by boat, another one by... trying to drive, through Russia, Alaska,
yeah.
Then another one flying, destination is the same, but the time will differ.
Yes, that's what he said. That's true. I went to, last year, I went to a wedding in Toronto, Canada, and we drove from New York. It's physically possible. You can drive. You drive past Niagara Falls and everything. Very pleasant. But it took 8 hours. This time I was going to a wedding in Chicago, and it took us just over an hour. It's different. Can anybody tell me the example the Prabhupada used about the being in a tall building trying to get to the top? Govinda? Yes, the lift or the stairs. Therefore, you see, sometimes Prabhupada would say that all paths are the same, and at other times he would discriminate, and he would say, but we'll get you to the top, but it may take some time. Here he's saying something else. What's he saying, Govinda? He's discriminating. He's saying that if you worship, people say that yatamat tatapat, yatamata tatapata, that all paths are the same, that whoever you worship, whether it's Kali or Durga or Ganesh or Surya or the impersonal Brahman, everything will get you to the same place. What does he say here? He's saying it's not true. Yes.
It's not,
he's saying it's not guaranteed.
Like for example, if somebody's trying to build a plane,
but he has no knowledge in that, but he's trying to do it himself. It's not guaranteed that he will do it. Mm. But if he has the right guidance, and if he goes to study, and he's under somebody who knows how to do it, then it's guaranteed that he will do it.
Mm.
But if he's just doing it independently, there's no guarantee.
Mm.
He's just speculating.
Mm.
He can go on forever, but he might still not do it.
Mm. So. Yes, I, for the last 40 years, I've been going to people's homes, and they've been inviting me to see their sacred items. So sometimes it's a crystal, sometimes it's a dream catcher, sometimes it's a peacock feather, sometimes it's this or that. And it's all those, and pictures of the people that they hold in great esteem. So, in one sense, I would never go to someone's house and say, well, actually, but I would speak in such a way as to help them to move from where they are to the next level of understanding, in as polite and as British a way as I possibly could. I'm not a hammer preacher generally. I'm a sort of rhubarb and custard preacher. I sort of move people along gradually and help them to enjoy at the same time. But sometimes we have to be hammers, don't we? But just make sure that the person that you're speaking to is a nail before you be a hammer. Okay? One who conceives himself as a hammer imagines everyone to be a nail. You know, there was a great devotee known as Vyadiraj Tirtha in the Madhva Sampradaya. And it said when the words came out of his mouth, they were just like a hammer. A hammer blow. He dealt the hammer blow to other philosophers. That was his approach. So we have devotees like that in our movement. Pretty much everything they say is a hammer. Mention no names. We have other devotees in our movement who are very smooth, very palatable speakers. But according to the person who's in front of you, therefore Prabhupada said, he said one time it is like this. He said, well, no, he didn't actually. I can't tell you when he said it, so maybe he didn't say it. There's a man in Vrindavan who makes pots. He takes a sheet of metal and by tap, 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 he turns a flat sheet of metal into a pot. So there must be a mental conception of a pot in order to turn a flat sheet into a pot. No mental conception of perfection or the end goal, and the taps won't reveal anything. No support on the inside, the pot will collapse. No tapping on the outside, the pot will not be formed. He said the guru is also like that. He taps on the outside, but from within, he supports you. So support, encouragement, guidance, softness, affection is required by the teacher. Similarly, tap, 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 this is not correct, this is not correct, this is the wrong shape. And to be in a room with Prabhupada was simultaneously to feel wonderfully supported by this generous being who seemed to be with Krishna at every moment. And yet, at the same time, you know, why is your bead bag dirty? Why are you so morose? Are you chanting your rounds? Are you reading my books? Why are you not reading my books? I am, Srila Prabhupada, I am reading my books. You say that you're reading my books. Anyone who is reading my books would understand this point. So both there, if you could take both the tapping and the support. Difficulty is, can you take the tapping? It's difficult. So here in this purport, Prabhupada is tapping. We should learn from this. He's saying that demigod worship and Krishna worship are not the same because Krishna is the supreme being and the demigods are merely angas of that supreme being. Is that okay? I went to, just for interest, because I'd heard for many, many years about Mayavadis, but I'd never really met one. Not really in the UK. We don't see them walking down the road. So I went to Mayavadi HQ, which is a place called, there's four places like that. It's called Sringeri. I went to Udupi first to see Madhvacharya's place. Then up the road to Sringeri, and I was the last in the line of people to meet the person who was the former pope of the Shankara school. I was the last in the line, and I asked him for his blessings. I said, because I'm giving Dharma in the West, give me your blessings. He says, yes, give me your blessings. Okay. By his blessings, I'm still here. No, not exactly. And I said, Maharaj, I said, he was saying, sorry, I have to go and do my puja. I said, Maharaj, who are you worshipping? He said, Krishna. He smiled at Krishna. I said, oh, very nice, Maharaj. So, can you bless me that I will always chant Krishna's names? He said, yes, you chant Krishna's names, you'll always be healthy. You'll always be physically healthy. I said, what about moksha? He said, for that there are other mantras. So immediately he exposed his impression. So what they do is they have five... They have five gods that they worship. Five gods are Surya, Ganesh, Shiva, Durga, like that. And Yatamat Tatapat became very popular under the auspices of people like Sri Ramakrishna and Vivekananda in Bengal at the time. You see, my dear friends, the difficulty was the British. The British helped to bring it all about because the British were Christians in Bengal at that time. No fixed conception of God, but a fixed conception of the human incarnation of God, Jesus, which is all very wonderful. God the Father, no fixed conception. God the Son, fixed conception, because he comes in history. So the British did not take kindly to the Hindus bowing down before statues. One, because it didn't agree with Christianity and they wanted to spread Christianity. Second reason is that because of Moses, what happened between Moses and the Israelites when he came down from the mountain and he saw that they'd been worshipping a golden calf. They'd melted all their gold into a golden calf. They were worshipping the golden calf. This weekend, of course, is Shavuot. It is the time when Moses received the commandments on the mountain. But just after he gets the commandments from God, he comes and he sees that which is not God. You see, it's worshipping of the statue. So therefore, one of the Ten Commandments that he received on the mountain this weekend, a long time ago, is thou shalt not bow down to any graven image. Any graven image is made out of stone or wood or metal like that. So there's a big problem there, that God should forever be shapeless, formless, and ultimately nameless. Because in the Bible reveals, who is it Who does God say that he is? I am. I am who I am. I am who I am. Well, that doesn't give much away, does it? Now here come the Hindus. No, we can tell you exactly how many buttons God has on his shirt. We can tell you how, to the inch, how long his flute is. And did you know God has three flutes? Did you know he plays different flutes for different occasions? We can tell you exactly how many cows he has and their names. It's enough to make the British be very... So from that came this Calcutta was the capital, of course, and they put this pressure on the Hindus to drop the statues, and we'll practically be the same. That's why the connection between Britain and Islam is very much more affectionate than the connection between Britain and Hinduism. Because British and Islam, we can understand you. You also worship a God with no name and no form and no shape and no statues. You're pretty much like us. But Hindus, we're trying to work out who you are. We're really trying to work out who you are. You seem to worship everything. So then the best jobs were English-speaking jobs run by Christian bosses in the employ of the British civil service. So upper class in Bengal of the 1800s became Christian, English educated, and perhaps a little bit more compromised in your Hindu beliefs. So from this flowered things like Dayanand Saraswati and the Arya Samaj and Vivekananda and Ramakrishna, and all these ideas, they bubbled up into a culture where people would be poorer if they bowed down to a statue of Krishna. Imagine that the money for worshipping Krishna would be much less. But if you could prove that you were acceptable to your Christian British overlords. So from this, we get modern day Hinduism. This is one of the elements in modern day Hinduism. So Prabhupada, being born in that era, his purports are filled with, really he's talking about something which was very prevalent at that time and has gone on to the present moment. It's not that it began at that time, but it's just that it was helped by this social agency, that it was politically expedient for you. One time in Vrindavan, Prabhupada was talking about the Arya Samaj. And Arya Samaj, wonderful people, we offer our respects, if anybody's watching. Follow the Vedas, fire sacrifices, very good. But Prabhupada was talking to people in his disciples in Vrindavan, Krishna Balaram temple. And he was commenting that the Arya Samaj temple was empty, but that the Krishna temple was filled. And he made the same observation when he came to the West, when he meets a police chief in Chicago, a Lieutenant Mosey, and he says, "Your churches are empty, our temples are full. Why then don't you just give us a church? We will fill it up and we will take all the young men who have trouble with drugs and we'll introduce them to something that will help them get off drugs." And Lieutenant Mosey says, "Swamiji, I think that would be a very good idea." But Prabhupada never got that church. It's a nice temple now, but... Anyway, so he's in Vrindavan. Are we okay with this sort of approach? It's a sort of conversational approach. It's because I spend most of my time in people's front rooms. Otherwise, I can give you a thundering class as well. But he says the Arya Samaj temple is empty. That our temple is full. He looks at the deities. He says, "Why is our temple full?" And he says one word, "Ashnami." Ashnami. Who knows what that means? Ashnami. Means I eat. He says, Krishna says, "If you offer me patram pushpam palam toyam, you offer me these things, I will accept. I will eat." Krishna says he eats. And we accept. And if you accept that Krishna says that he will eat, he said, then this establishes your relationship with Krishna. This is bhakti. And therefore you will feel something in the heart and therefore you will come to this temple and not to that temple. It wasn't a sectarian competition. Prabhupada was using the emptiness of one temple and the full to bursting situation in another temple to make a point, to highlight a point. See? This is all in the context, of course, of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu speaking to Ramananda Roy. And in this conversation with Ramananda Roy, we go up the spectrum of religion. Religion is a spectrum, beginning at the crudest level. Everybody knows my story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati preaching to the Adivasis in Burma. You know, they preached in Burma, what we now call Myanmar. If you just go over the border of, where is it, Assam and Manipur, you get to Burma. So he was preaching in Burma, and they came to this Adivasi village, a sort of aboriginal village, and they were still preparing nice khichdi and halva and puris. This is preaching, kirtan and prasadam. So in this village, they had a part of their culture, and I put culture in air apostrophes here, part of their culture, was that if there was any roadkill, any dead animals, they would put them in a barrel, and they would leave them there. And then they would add another dead animal, and another dead animal, and another dead animal. These old animals would stack up, and they would rot, and flies would come, and the maggots, and everything would decompose. You'll see where I'm going with this. It would all decompose. And on the bottom of the barrel, there was a tap. And when they turned on the tap, for festivals only, there was a black juice, which was the condensed essence of rotting flesh. And this they would sprinkle like soy sauce on their rice. So in this village, he tried to preach. So they were frying some puris. And the people of the village all gathered around and said, "Oh, what's that disgusting smell? Oh, that's disgusting." Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati later said, he said, "I came from the spiritual world to give Krishna prem and the love of the gopis for Krishna." He said, "But all my life I've spent hacking away at the jungles of sense gratification." Preaching is hard work. And therefore, Prabhupada said many times, he said, for one soul to be delivered, gallons of blood, just to bring one person to understand what is this movement. So for those of you who were expecting a higher level, let's go from that level to the higher level now. Because in this purport, of which we have covered two paragraphs, we are getting into the topic of the conjugal rasa. We've gone up from Varnashram through the different understandings of the relationship with God. And in this verse, we're going to be talking about specifically the conjugal rasa with Krishna. So rasa means, it means a flavor. Many years ago, we don't see too many of them in Bhaktivedanta Mala these days. Thank you for making it through. What's your name? Bhaktivedanta David. Saint David from now on. There's only one of them, except Murali Manohar, and he's transcended. He's descended. So, and Prabhuji, of course, propping up the walls. We have, when I was young, I was introduced to something that I thought was absolutely wonderful. And it was called Mango Rasa, see? Just to say the word, everybody breaks into a smile. Mango Ras. Alfonso Mango Ras. I didn't know that such taste could exist in this world. I didn't know. What sort of movement have I joined? I just didn't. I'd been brought up on apples and, you know, maybe a few bitter strawberries. And we lived in Cornwall. We didn't get out much. So then I went to Leicester and stayed with the Chaturbhuj family. Many people know them. And of course we were sadhus from the temple. So they treated sadhus like sadhus. And at the end of the meal, which in itself was a revelation, Dokra. What's a dokra? What's a dokra? And they gave mango ras, and oh my word, my head exploded. So rasa or rasam is the flavor which is the essence of a fruit. And a ripened fruit, an ancient medieval word for ripened fruit, the taste of a ripened fruit is mellowa, mellowa, ancient English. So from that we get the word mellow. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used this taste, this ancient English word that no one really uses to say mellow. So that's why the devotees talk about going to Radhadesh mellows, New Vrindavan mellows. What the heck is a mellow? And you'll find devotees who may be not that good at English trying to explain to a guest at Bhaktivedanta Manor, you know, it's a mellow. And they'll go, you know what I mean? And the guest will go, yeah, they'll nod their head. It's a word that no one understands. Just nobody uses the word, okay? Anyway, so rasa. And rasa actually means the emotional flavor of a relationship. And when Rupa Goswami, 500 years ago, wrote his Bhakti Rasa, Amrita Sindhu, the ocean of such flavors, he used language that people of his time could understand. So in his day, the word rasa and bhava and sattvika bhava and anubhava and vyabhichari bhava and vibhava, these are all words used by playwrights, people who wrote plays. And they were the ways that the playwright would get the actors to work in a certain way to bring out emotions in the audience. Was it something I said? They're all leaving. So this is the idea that rasa is composed of bhavas. And when you take these five bhavas all together, that is the five constituents of rasa. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Jiva Dharma had another analogy. And he used the analogy of an ocean. He said, just like an ocean, the stai bhava is like the water. It's like the whole. He said, there's water, then there's the wind, which causes the water to move, then there are waves, and then there's froth and foam. And like that, there's different constituents. But the whole thing is called the ocean. So rasa is like an ocean, which has different elements in it. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was a few chapters after this, when he's in chapter 20, 21, 22, when he's speaking to Sanatana and Rupa, he says, he uses another analogy. He says, love of God or these rasas are like, he's like the taste of sugar cane, taste of sugar. He says, first there is the sugar cane seed, and then we go to the sugar cane juice, and then we go to the sugar cane gore. I was in Vrindavan once, and I watched them make sugar cane juice into sugar gore. Have you ever seen that process? They boil it down. Early in the morning, you catch a whiff of it on the road as you're walking along. You go, and you smell this sugarcane juice being boiled into gore, and you get a thick one. To drink hot gore straight from the boiling pan in Vrindavan on the way to Radhakund, this is a special treat. Unfortunately, your stomach and your intestines the next morning do not thank you for such a treat. But at the time, it's heavenly. So then he goes on and he says, and ultimately, pure love of God, pure prema is like the crystals, the lozenges, the sugar candy. Actually, these two words, sugar, they're both Sanskrit, sugar and candy. Kandar and shakar both come from Sanskrit. Anyway, so these are some of the things that we'll be talking about. So, what is sugar? Yes, it's the juice. Yes, it's if you see a field of green sugar cane growing 8 feet, 10 feet tall, that's sugar. No problem. That is sugar. And so if someone waves it to the point and says, this is sugar. Sugar cane juice. Is that sugar? Yes, it's sugar. Sugar gore. Is that sugar? Yes, it's definitely sugar. Sugar crystals, that's definitely sugar. Sugar candy, that's definitely sugar. Sugar lozenges, crystals, the ultimate sugar lozenge. So that's actually as far as you can go. Therefore, there's two things in our Krishna consciousness movement. One is helping people to understand the beginnings of the pathway. And for that we use certain entreaties and certain explanations, more in keeping with what they can understand. If you're not speaking so that people can understand, what are you doing? You're just showing off. You're using jargon that they won't understand, either English or Sanskrit. I listened to someone speaking to a newcomer in the lobby, and they said, yes, yes, we also believe in one God, just one God. No, no, we're not Hindus. We don't worship many gods. We only worship one God. Then I followed them into the... I was just listening, just casually pretending to be looking at something else. Maybe I wasn't quite dressed like this. And they came in front of the altar. They said, these are the deities. See what's happening? We only worship one God, and these are the deities, all of them. How many deities? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11. 11 deities, and these are the deities. It needs to be unpackaged. You need to be as simple as possible when people are beginning bhakti, and as complicated as you like when you're trying to define what actually leads to love of God. So we see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's explanation to some people. Then you see these discussions with Ramananda Roy, and they're in a completely different category. How to sum up the person that you're speaking to know how to speak to them. Listen to them first. If you look at Prabhupada's classes, it's all Prabhupada speaking. If you look at Prabhupada's room conversations, there are the multi-volume series of room conversations that Prabhupada had. You will find that most of it is other people talking. And you're thinking, well, why do I have to get through all this in order to get to a Prabhupada? Because this is, if you sat in a room with Prabhupada, actually sat in a room with Prabhupada, you'll find that most of the time, Prabhupada was listening. Most of the time he's listening. Listen, 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 and then speak. And once Prabhupada started speaking, then he was, as we say, on a roll. And then the other person had to listen. And sometimes Prabhupada would push a little bit, so, no, no, try and understand. No, just this one thing. So Prabhupada would continue speaking. But a lot of listening is required in order to preach. Hare Krishna. You've been wonderful. I've been Kripa Moya Das. Let us... where should we go? A couple of questions. We'll finish at 1:45. Is it a normal day today, or what is it? Breakfast is late. Okay, so let's have a challenge. Throw a debate at me. They say, someone. What if someone says, try that. Yes.
As we're talking about preaching, sorry. First of all, thank you for the wonderful insights on this verse and your purport. It's very nice to hear. So if in the Ten Commandments it says not to bow down to something which is made, then what's the kind of Vedic take on it? So when we're having like interfaith discussions or we're preaching, how does one kind of bring the two points together?
Do you do interfaith discussions? It's got to be the most challenging thing. I can't do them. I've done interfaith so long. I was asked to do a wedding, one of my many weddings, and the parents of the groom came, and I mentioned the word fire. They were staunch Catholics, Christian Catholics, or Catholic Christians. And fire for them meant one thing, you know, that we had to be saved from fire. And I said, no, we start a fire. And your son and his bride will walk around the fire. And the looks on their faces were just, you know, because for a Catholic, you know, there's heaven is light, but hell is hellfire. This is, you know. And I'd forgotten that. I said, and my rather quickly, I said, no, this is not that fire. I said, this is the fire that was between Moses and God. This was the burning bush fire. Do you remember when Moses came and he saw a bush that was burning, but it wasn't being consumed? And this was God coming to him to tell him to set his people free. And in the presence of that fire, Moses was asked to take off his shoes. So therefore, in the presence of the holy fire that we will kindle for your son and new daughter-in-law, this is that fire. And it was almost like the blood came back to their faces. And they were, oh, okay. So regarding graven images, people do find it, I found it very strange. I liked everything in Krishna consciousness up to that point. Then I came back from book distribution one weekend. And right here I saw three grown men. They were sort of older men, you know, like 23, 24. And it was daily greeting. It doesn't happen so much these days, daily greeting. And the tears were just streaming down their faces. And I thought, my God, either they're faking it or they're making it. And if I want some of what they're on. So it must be real. So for me, a sort of invisible wall had been broken between the deities and myself. So I entertained the possibility that God might possibly, perhaps, appear in a deity form. So then they said to me, well, you know, we can do deity worship in the van. And there was a little picture of Panchatattva on the dashboard, because we were after 3 days I was traveling. We didn't have access to the deities here. It was always a special treat when we came back at the weekend. So every morning I took a small flower and I offered it to a picture of Panchatattva. And I think that by that act of just offering a flower to Krishna in his most merciful form, I finally got it. And one evening, as the sun was setting, we were driving from Lincoln up to Hull, or maybe Grimsby, on the A15 in a Ford Transit. The devotee turned to me and he said, what you're not understanding and what you've got to understand, he said, that just like I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, we're having a conversation, that one day you will be able to have a conversation with Krishna face to face. And then he stopped talking, and I just looked out the windscreen. And somehow, in a distant corner of my mind, a penny dropped. Clink. And I turned to him and I said, okay. He said, do you get it? I said, yeah, I think so. He said, it's nice when that happens, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. So normally Prabhupada would say something like, we don't say graven image. We don't say we manufacture the deity. We do not invent the form of Krishna. Firstly, Krishna's form is given in Shastra. Then Krishna's form is given in revelation to great munis. And if we examine the life of these great munis and sages, and we'll see what transcendental consciousness they lived in, then we'll say when they describe the appearance of God, then we have that. So when God actually appears as a revelation to a Muni, when a Muni sees in his mystic meditation the form of God, when God actually appears, and then when God comes on the surface of the world to reveal himself. Well, I believe in God if I could see God. You know, because seeing is believing. So if God appears in front of me, then I'd believe God. So then, as Sariputta once said, Richard Thompson, he's a mathematical genius. He said, he just goes like this, and he goes, well, then God does appear, and he says, hello, I'm God. I'm here. Do you then believe in him or not? And Prabhupada, in the discussion with Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu, he said, Hiranyakashipu did not believe in God, so he could not see him, even when God appeared in front of him. Prahlad Maharaj believed in God, so he could see him everywhere, even though he was invisible. So sometimes people say, seeing is believing. But we say, believing is seeing. Ah, some people go, But then you say that you have to believe first in order that you appreciate Krishna. What do you say to that, Mr. Vishwambar?
Just something came to my mind. I was invited to give a class in Scotland, Karuna Bhavan, many years ago. And there was a teacher with a group of children. They came to visit the temple, you know, Orthodox, British, Scottish children. And they saw a devotee washing all the 3,500 stones, you know, there.
Shalabhashila.
And one of the child said, what is so special about this stone? And the pujari turned around and said, they are God. So the teacher was scratching his head, you know, and they walked out. Said, yeah. God, a stone, all these stones, they're God. Mm. So it was, I had to actually salvage the situation. I had to explain, you know, the background of the, you know, the stones, who are those stones, Govardhan Shila.
Mm.
But anyway, but yeah, there are so many, in so many ways God can appear, you know, in the stone.
Burning bush. Pillar of fire.
That's it.
Pillar of smoke.
It's everywhere. It's in everything.
Yeah.
Already.
But generally speaking, the form of Krishna, I'm speaking to you, this lady here. Okay, she's moved on. Yeah, this was an answer to you. Generally speaking, first principles come first. First things first. You know, how do you make something suitable to a person's understanding? Well, you understand their understanding first. It's very difficult for people to understand God, first of all. It's amazing. We should be very careful, and I'll just say this as a conclusion. Right now, we are in the grip of a multi-pronged attack on Western civilization. You must understand. It started 50s and 60s. It's called postmodernism. It matured into something called critical race theory or theory. And it has evolved into something that people now call cultural Marxism. And the idea is to do away with religion entirely. So even the concept, what to speak of, you know, sugar and waves and foam and wind and multiple understandings of Godhead, forms of Godhead. You know, people don't even know what a woman is. You know, I never thought I would live to see the day when in the Houses of Parliament someone was asked, what is a woman? And a person would say something like, a woman is whatever, whoever identifies as a woman is a woman. I mean, people don't even understand their sex. They don't even understand their gender. So family, the family is under attack. Gender is under attack. History is under attack. They're toppling statues at a rate now. Don't be surprised if people come for this temple. Don't be surprised. Prabhupada said, if they actually knew what was in my books, you know, in other words, if the opponents of my movement actually understood what was in my books, they would arrest me. And how much more now? Now we even have devotees practically speaking, reading Prabhupada's purports and saying, I can't agree with this, I can't agree with this, I can't agree with this. Because Prabhupada's purports looked at through the lens of cultural Marxism, which first of all attacked the universities, then the teacher training colleges, and is now even in the primary schools. It's so insidious that we don't even know that it's there. The cultural changes that have come about, even Prabhupada himself, I think, would be somewhat surprised. So do not be surprised if they come for these books. Don't be surprised. You know, if they actually understood what was in these books, what we were proposing for human society. They're trying to get rid of any understanding that history even has any. To a Marxist, history is something that precipitates the modern world. The modern world, through process of revolution, is working towards a state of where there is no hierarchy at all, even natural hierarchies. So with this conception, don't be surprised if what we have in Prabhupada's books becomes number one difficulty for people. And so therefore, our movement is not over its challenges. It's only just begun. If we were successful, we'd have more problems. Now we're just politely on the fringes of society. But as soon as they read the books, we sell the books, but they don't read them. And the ones that read them, they come and they say, you know, why don't you have any women gurus? Why use? Because immediately they get a book, they go on the internet and they find all the protest. So there's a subculture of protest against Prabhupada's books and Prabhupada's movement. So immediately they find that, they come. And it takes, how long does it take now for a person to find out what's wrong with Prabhupada's books? 3 weeks? 2 weeks? So they get a book on the street. Therefore, preaching does not begin with book distribution. It begins with what happens after they read a book. It begins with what happens after they go on the internet. It begins with when the first challenges come. You said this, but everybody knows this. And whatever is modern culture, and whatever is the sort of radical culture that we now live in, is, well, everybody knows that to be truth. But just as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy are going through categories, everything in the world, both material and spiritual, is placed in a category. This is called Sankhya, or enumeration, categorization. But it's done according to a predominant philosophy. So whatever is your ultimate concept of reality, you will categorize the world in a particular way. If your ultimate conception of what human society should be is gross materialism, you'll categorize everything. Therefore, the most dangerous thing is what is written in Prabhupada's books, because they're a complete turnaround to. So if you want to start a revolution, distribute books and speak about Krishna consciousness. If you want the revolution to be stopped, stop speaking immediately a person says, but all religions are the same. Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.